Hello, everybody. All right, I'm going to challenge you. I'm interactive, so yeah, just saying things right out there when I ask questions is perfectly legal with me. Okay, so does anybody know what that picture is? That's Fiddler on the Roof. What's the opening song of Fiddler on the Roof? Tradition, tradition, right? Tradition in you, and we're going to talk about particularly Matthew 2, 1 through 12, but I want to start with traditions. And we're in the season of traditions right now. Would you agree? There are many traditions that we've created in our families and our communities throughout the country around this time of Christmas. So here are a bunch of traditions, right? There's a world of tradition up there. There's, with all the stuff involved, one of my favorites is up in the top right corner, but he's getting hidden by the snowflake real quick. And that's Ralphie in A Christmas Story. You'll shoot your eye out. Another one is down here in the bottom right, and I kind of call it the triumvirate or the quad, the peak of Christmas tradition. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, right? 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, which is the mice and the clocks. You've got Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which was, and the reason I like Santa Claus is Coming to Town is because I can go, the Burger Meister, Meister Burger. Okay, so if you don't know that one, you'll get to know the Burger Meister, Meister Burger. And then Frosty the Snowman. That's like the four quintessential, it is Christmas season time when you see them come on TV, right? But multitude of Christmas movies here, a lot of them have Christmas in it, but what do they all kind of have in common? Where was it? Who was it? They don't have Christ in them. They say Christmas, but they don't have anything to do with Christ. In fact, on this list, there's only one that even sort of mentions it, which is which one? Charlie Brown Christmas Special, right? Linus gives his saying there. So we've created all forms of tradition around this time that have nothing to do with what the tradition was originally founded for. Do you agree? I mean, you can go through the entire Christmas season and not think one moment about why Christ was there or what happened. Here's another non-Christ Christmas tradition. It's not, and you can't read it up there, it's not Christmas until Hans Gruber falls from Nakatomi Plaza. Okay? And if you don't know what that is, sorry, that is the movie Die Hard. It's set during Christmas time. And so there's an argument that is Die Hard a Christmas movie or is it not? So my daughter argues it's not. I have to say, hi, Leah. I'm mentioning Leah's back at Grand Canyon. She will see this. But I did have to mention this for my daughter. So this one you can't really see too well, but you can. Does anybody have an idea of what that is? Nope, but close. Who knows what it came from and what are we talking about right here? They're the wise men. Okay, they are that. But do anybody know? This is from about 1985 and 1986. This is the one with the California raisins. Good call. Orion gets the square. Got it. This was the Claymation Christmas special from about 1985-86. And at this time, the California raisins were like the big thing on TV, the Claymation ones. Hardee's, or I think for you guys don't know Hardee's, you guys know Carl's Jr. They're the same company, but they had these California raisins, and they would sell them little figurines and stuff. But this is from the California, and this is the wise men, or what's the carol that we sing? We Three Kings. Okay, this is what we're going to talk about today, and this is a tradition that I'm talking about because the tradition is we sing a Christmas carol in church. We Three Kings of Orient are, or of Orient are, not Orient are. Anyway, R, yes, R. Here's the problem. They weren't kings, and there weren't three. Okay? So this is what we're going to go over today. We're going to do some history here, do some teaching, and so forth. Now, how in the world do I actually integrate James Bond into everything that I just said? Well, here's the deal. In 1993, I was a freshman at the University of Oklahoma. Go Sooners, right, Tim? Yeah, Boomer Sooner. Aside from a great football team, Oklahoma actually is a great school. They take great pride in being academically one of the highest in the nation outside of an Ivy League school. So their teachers at the school are really good. I actually ended up with a GA, graduate assistant, that was the teacher of our Composition 1 and Composition 2 class in my freshman year, and his name was quite literally James Bond. So that's why I get James Bond. He went by Jim. He was skinny guy, and he was incredibly excited about showing us something. And what he did was he showed us that everything you see in storytelling, whether it's in a movie, whether it's on TV, or whether it's in a book, was there for a reason. Somebody's trying to communicate you something. Somebody has an agenda trying to tell you something. Sometimes those agendas and those things are very simple. Cheers, right? TV show Cheers. Coach, when Coach died, one of the things they did was they took a picture of Geronimo and they put it on the back wall of the Cheers bar, and that was the homage to Coach, okay? Is there anything awful about that? Is there any nefarious plot in that? No, but there was a purpose for the picture that was on the wall in the back. Nothing is in a movie, nothing is in a story, nothing is in a television show without you knowing. CSI type shows, right? You get this random encounter in the first 10 minutes of the show with some janitor that has no purpose in being in the story. It's literally the main character just goes, "Oh, hi, Bob, thanks for cleaning my thing," and then walks away. And pretty soon, what do you end up with about 50 minutes later? The janitor did it, right? I mean, there's always a purpose behind why people do something, and this guy was incredible about teaching that to us for a year. His big one was the movie Thelma and Louise. He would get there, and in Thelma and Louise, every time you would see them driving in their little convertible car, two little women in a convertible car, you would see this big 18-wheeler truck right behind them, almost every single scene. And he'd be like, "There's that 18-wheeler again! I saw you! See!" He was so excited about it, but teaching us that there's purpose behind why things are being told to you. There's purpose in the traditions of the movies that are there, and they're not always great because they do take our focus off of who we should be focusing on, right? So we've actually done that to this Three Kings story. We've created Three Kings of Orientar instead of the true reason of what it is. So I'm going to read the story, and we're going to go over some of the history of this story. We're going to talk about tradition. So if you have your Bibles, it's Matthew 2, and we're going to be 1 through 12. And I got my handy-dandy screen at the back, so I read from over here. So, because my eyes. There we go. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem of Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be shepherd my people, Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly, found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them again until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. There's the story as Matthew tells it. Just a side note here. Matthew wrote his book, or wrote his, I would say book, wrote his testimony. The book of Matthew, we call it a book, but it was a letter written by Matthew as eyewitness testimony of who Jesus was. And one of the focus that Matthew had was Matthew was writing to Jewish people. Okay, so he's writing to Jews almost specifically, and he was proclaiming Jesus was a king. There's the purpose, right? So why do we have this story in the book of Matthew? Why would Matthew include this story in which Mark, John, and Luke does not include? Because this is not in Mark, Luke, and John. And one of the reasons is Matthew is proclaiming Jesus as king. And that's the purpose of this story here. I want to get into the characters that are in this story because this becomes important in understanding what all of this is about. So the first character we come across is during the time of King Herod. What was Herod most known? What do we know about Herod? Who knows? Throw something out there about Herod you might know. He killed his sons, what? That was his son. That was one of his sons. That wasn't actually this Herod. This King Herod is different than the other Herod. Okay? What else? Other things you might know about this guy named Herod. He built the temple. Okay? The temple was rebuilt by Herod into a more glorious form of the temple. It didn't meet the temple standards of what Solomon did way back many hundreds of years before. But Herod, in 19 BC, started to build a new temple and design it to be there. He actually didn't survive to see the temple being finished because the temple was finished in about 6 AD, and he died about 4 BC. So he didn't actually see it come. But Herod, very interesting guy. Herod was an Edomite, now, meaning this. He was not of Jewish descent. So he ends up ruler in a Jewish area, and he has nothing to do, really, in his history with the Jews. Edom was a country, and I'm going to use this as an example. Israel's kind of here on the left side of the buffer zone, and Edom was more in Jordan and that area and there. And Herod and his father were Edomites. They were not Jews. Rome became the ruling power at the time. And Rome was interesting because Rome said, we're in charge, but we're going to leave your guys' cultures quite a bit alone. They didn't have to conform necessarily to Roman culture to be a part of the Roman Empire. You could have your Jewish culture, and you can have your Greek culture, and you can have your religions, just as long as you live kind of peacefully within the Roman structure and paid taxes to them, basically, was what it was. So Rome put Herod's father, I think it was Herodotus, or there's a name in there, in charge of Jerusalem. And they actually instituted Herod up in the Galilee area, which is kind of where Jesus ended up coming from when he was in his time. So Herod didn't have much power. This was about 45 BC when this happened. But something interesting happened in history. This little group over here, the Parthian Empire, this actually before Rome took it over, was the Medo-Persian Empire, which actually took over for one of the first world great empires, which was what? Who? Babylon. Okay, Babylon became really the first world empire. Up to that point, all of the people that lived in nations and did different things, they would defeat somebody in a group, but they would kind of retreat back to their own area, take the spoils of war, but they wouldn't grow their land or their area too much. Babylon was the first really to come in and say, we're going to create a world empire. We're going to dominate a large section of the world map as much as we can. And one of the ways that they did that was actually integrating all these cultures into their own. We're going to get to that in a second. But at this point, Rome was in charge, but they had a problem. They had some areas that were constantly trying to encroach on the things that they were doing. One of them was the barbarian hordes of the Scandinavian area, the Germanic tribes, and so forth, up of their north. But another area of real concern to Rome was this Parthian area. Parthia, and this is now Iraq, what we know as Iraq and Iran, Persian, you'll hear it called the Persian Empire in many cases. This is the area in which, if you saw the movie 300, I will reference many movies in here, by the way. If you saw the movie 300, that was the armies were coming from Persian, that was Xerxes, that were coming to war against the Greeks at that time. But the Parthian Empire was a problem. It wasn't as much of a problem at this point because they were pretty much 1,000 miles away over desert. Bring in Herod. Herod takes over in Galilee. Soon, about 40 BC, the Parthian Empire starts to try to spread its legs. Starts to encroach to the west. And they start battling. And it just so happens that the area of battle is Israel. Israel becomes this buffer zone. That's why we call it the buffer zone, so to speak. This is that place where if the Parthians start to get through, Rome starts to become in trouble and some of their power starts to slip. So Herod Herod is actually, and we're going to talk about the good of Herod, Herod is actually very smart and a great leader. So in his brilliance, he actually escaped out of Galilee, ran to Rome, not running, so to speak, to say I'm running away from them, but got with the Roman Senate and said, hey, you guys have a problem. This Persian army is coming, and they're coming to invade, and they're making trouble here. You need to send me back, but send me back with an army of your soldiers so that we can defeat the Parthians and move them back to where they want to come and basically secure your buffer zone again. It's brilliant in this. He now has started to ingratiate himself to the Roman Senate. So he goes back and in 37 AD wins the war, wins the fight against the Parthians, pushes them back, and Rome and the Senate at this point give him actual power in Israel. And he actually becomes the ruler of all of Israel in terms of the way Rome would set up some ruler aside from themselves. And Herod, what moniker does Herod take on himself at this point? What does he call himself now that he rules Jerusalem? All right, Herod the Great, but there's also, how about another one? King of the Jews. He called himself King of the Jews. If I've knocked that over, we're going to start a fire. Okay, so he took great pride in calling himself King of the Jews. That's what he wanted. Herod not only was a great leader, he was a great builder. We talked about the fact that he built the temple, but he also built many buildings throughout all of Judea and even north. Many of the buildings in Syre, Antioch, which is north of the buffer zone, and actually almost built the entire city of Caesarea. Caesarea was kind of this coastal city in Israel that was a vacation retreat, so to speak, for the elite of both Israel and Rome. And he built that entire city along with some buildings actually in Athens. So he was so renowned that the Greeks actually had him come put together some buildings that were in Athens. Many of the buildings around Jerusalem were constructed or designed by Herod. Herod was a great leader and a great builder. And he had pretty good instincts on how to rule people, okay? Problem with Herod, though, as with anybody that gains power, is he was kind of a power maniac, right? And that led to a ruthlessness in him. Herod was very ruthless. Once he gained power, once he's king of the Jews, he actually married into a line of people that were in charge of Israel before him. They were called the Hasmoneans. Really comes from the Maccabees, the Maccabee Revolution that happened against the Greeks in 300 BC. But there was this line of people that used to be in charge of Israel and no longer now were in charge of them. But one of the things he did, he married into that line, but then he conspired against that line to kill off as many of those that might usurp his role in charge as he could. And he started to do it in sneaky ways. He was very sneaky. You find, I think the very first one was the brother of his wife, and he took him to and had he they went to a vacation retreat in Jericho, and they went swimming, and he had his soldiers in the water there, you know, hey, go in the water, got him to go in the water, and his soldiers in there playing with him, and then just all of a sudden just drug him under and just kind of held him there for a little while, and that ended, and then had a huge funeral and cried and all that fun stuff, trying to be sneaky about it, ended up killing a couple of his wives. But one of the most ruthless stories of Herod is this. As he aged, as he was getting to the time of his death, so the last couple years of his age, he became more paranoid because illnesses and sicknesses, and he really wanted to get rid of some people. So he did. But then, right before he died, he called to his all of his people and the soldiers under his command and said this. I want you to go into all of Jerusalem. I want you to find all of the elite Jews that you can that are in prominence, power, have some kind of role. You jail them right now, okay? And then on the day of my death, when I die, I want you to walk in and execute every last one of them. The purpose behind him doing this, he said this. No one's going to mourn my death. I'm an Edomite ruler that nobody likes. But I want there to be great mourning in Jerusalem and in Judea when I die. That's who he was. That's who these guys went to see. Okay? Second group of people that are involved in here, Magi. This gets translated in some of your Bibles as wise men, which is where we get wise men. But the reality behind the word magi is a Greek word that actually is not a translatable word. It doesn't mean anything. We've corrupted it in the English, magi, and what other words might come from magi? Magic, magician, so forth. And you're going to understand why when I talk about this group of people, how that came across. But that wasn't the intent of this word. Magi were actually a tribe of people from the Medes, the M-E-D-E-S, the Mede people. That's where we got the Medo-Persian Empire that ruled before Greek, or that ruled after the Greek, but before the Roman Empire, okay? This tribe of people in the Medes, actually, they think goes back almost all the way to Abraham. It's kind of an argument, so to speak, whether it got as far as Abraham or not. But they're a very ancient tribe of people in the Medes. Their special skills, okay, included astronomy, reading of the stars, but also astrology, a supernatural reading of the stars. It's amazing at this time how much true science that we would know mixes with the supernatural arts that they know. They intermingled. There wasn't a definitive, oh, here's science and here's the supernatural. They kind of ran both of them together. They were known as sorcerers. They had some form of divination skills, occultic skills, so to speak. They understood, or they tried to master fire. They were big into fire. So, you know, if you can imagine the Arabian type stuff with, you know, the powders and so forth. So when we look at magi, and we try to understand who they were, we three kings. They weren't kings. They didn't actually have power. They were much more like that guy. That is Aladdin. That is Jafar. Now, silly, but this is a better illustration of who the Magi would have been. He was a counselor to the king. And the Magi, okay, the Magi themselves, when Nebuchadnezzar began to rule the world about 500-600 years before this, Nebuchadnezzar did something interesting. He took the biggest, the best, the brightest of all of these nations and brought them into his council, taught them Babylonian ways, but also used their skill sets and things for his greatest benefit. So he brought this Magi group in. And these guys, because of their wisdom, because of their skills, because of their occultic abilities, their ability to interpret dreams, they became counselors, or sort of the right-hand man of Nebuchadnezzar at this point. So when he had things to ask, things to do, he went to this group called the Magi, okay? So they're a part of that. As time moved on, Babylon gets taken over by the Medo-Persians, and the Medo-Persians just kind of keep this same thing going along. They kind of hold, hey, these guys are pretty good for Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to hold their same status in there. And the Persians actually did something unique with the Magi. They grew in stature so much that the Magi became the people. In other words, if someone was to become king of the Persians, the first thing they had to know was the way of the Magi. They had to understand what the Magi were doing. Second thing they had to be was they had to actually be approved by the current Magi was there. You couldn't be a king in Persia. You couldn't be Xerxes or Artaxerxes or Cyrus the Great or all these people that we'd heard about throughout this empire without the Magi actually approving of you. So they weren't kings, but they certainly were king makers, right? They were the ones that made the kings be who they were in what they did, okay? I bring that to say this. In this story, what happened? This group of Persian sorcerer kingmakers, okay, gathered together for some reason, and they wouldn't have come with three. They wouldn't be three. They would be a bunch of them together. They could be 12, 15, 20, 100 for all we know, but they would have traveled with an entourage. An entourage would have included warriors from the Persian Empire, and it would have been a large gathering, maybe 1,000 people traveling the thousands of miles to get to Jerusalem. Here comes this caravan into Jerusalem to a guy, Herod, who understood exactly who they were. He knew who they were. He was an Edomite. He was from the east, or from the east at this point. He knew exactly what they were. And this group walks in to paranoid, coming onto his deathbed at this point, Herod, saying what? We're here to look for the new king of the Jews. Now, when it said Herod was troubled, what do you think he was? He was a troubled man at this point. You've got people saying he knows exactly who these guys are. He knows what they're capable of. And he knows better than to try to establish influence over them right now. They have right now, he's actually somewhat afraid of them. He doesn't have the ability to kill them or move them on, right? So Herod, there's purpose in understanding who they were in there. But it also develops another interesting question. Why did the Magi come looking for the king of the Jews? Right? Have you ever asked, I mean, this is a question that these guys just saw this thing in the West and said, hey, let's all get together. Let's make this 1,000-mile journey to see something and understand who the king of the Jews are. Why in the world would they do that? Okay. 500 years before, when we talk about Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar brought in what? The best and the brightest, right? What other group of people did Nebuchadnezzar bring in the best and the brightest of? The Jews. He conquered Israel. This is Israeli captivity at this point. So he goes and gets the best and the brightest of the Jewish nation, including four individuals: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and what other man? Daniel. Daniel's 16, okay? This guy's young. He comes in, and here's the best and the brightest, and they're trying to teach them the Babylonian ways. And the Magi, these individual sorcerers, are all around Nebuchadnezzar. And very early on in Daniel's time with them, he establishes the fact that he is a man of God, the true God in Israel, and not of the gods of Nebuchadnezzar and of the Babylonians. Well, soon, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Dream disturbs him, right? Dream. So he gets up and he kind of gets wise on this whole thing. He's like, I got this figured out. He says, guys, I had a dream, and the dream's disturbing to me. And you're the Magi, and you've got all these divination skills. So not only do I want you to interpret my dream, I'm not going to tell you what my dream is. You have to come up with it. Well, the Magi sit there and go, well, that's unfair. That's not fair. What do you mean you can't tell us what it is? If you just tell us, we'll tell you the meaning of it. He's like, no, if you're truly who you say you are, this is Nebuchadnezzar, you will know my dream and you will tell it to me. And they go, we can't do that. So Nebuchadnezzar, in his megalomaniac Nebuchadnezzar ways, gets angry and says, you're done. And when Nebuchadnezzar says you're done, he's killing you, and you're dead. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar, that's who he was. So these guys are right there on the edge of being destroyed. As a tribe, as a people, the Magi are about to be gone. And in walks this young kid named Daniel. And Daniel says, I believe God will tell me the interpretation of your dream. Give me a night, and I'll do it. Don't do anything to the Magi. I'm going to figure this out. Daniel prays to God, comes back, interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and saves the lives of these very Magi that 500 years later are traveling to Jerusalem. Many times throughout the book of Daniel, there's a couple times instances where Daniel became so much influence with the people in that area that he became head of the Magi. He was the top Magi, so to speak, the top advisor, the top almost prince, not only for Nebuchadnezzar, but he was so good at this that Cyrus and Darius of the Medo-Persian Empire put him in charge of this. For 70 years, Daniel had a huge place of influence amongst this society, and one of them was head of this group of advisors known as the Magi. Now, do you think a man of God like Daniel that would do the things that he did in faith with God would not have shared with them all of the prophecies about the Jewish people that he would have known? It's exactly what he did. So 500 years later, when this group of Magi, who'd been under the tutelage of Daniel for 70 years, come to see a sign in the west, they go, that's it. That's the sign. And so when they come into Jerusalem, they're not just looking for something unique. They're actually looking for something specific, the very king of the Jews. That's the tradition. That's why they came that way. A little bit about the star, because but they saw a star. There's a lot of conjecture about the star. You may even see news stories about how Jupiter is in a line with Venus and Saturn and whatever, and that might have been what actually was done. The star was very simply, we saw a star when it rose and have come to worship. They saw a star, they saw in the east, that triggered them to know to go to Jerusalem. The star didn't guide them to Jerusalem because they didn't know where to go. They just knew, we're going to Jerusalem. Once they get to Jerusalem, they have to ask where he's going to be born. They say in Bethlehem. Once they make their travels again, the star appears back to them and actually this time leads them to the very house that Jesus is in. This is actually probably 6 to 8 to 12 months after Christ's birth. They would have seen the sign of his birth, made the travels, which would not have, they wouldn't, you know, they're not going to get there overnight from 1,000 miles away in, you know, 4 BC. Okay? So they come, they find the house where Jesus is at this point. He's no longer in a manger. They're in a place, but they're just getting to the point of being able to go back home after her pregnancy and so forth. And they walk in and they worship a child. And they bow down. These Persian kingmakers bow down to a child. Okay? And what do? They present them gifts. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And there's a lot of talk about what these possibly could mean and this, you know, the spiritual significance of it. I'm going to just go with it's gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And I'm going to go with the fact that the star was a supernatural event that was shown to these guys. I don't need a natural explanation for it with the God of the universe. The God of the universe showed them a sign and then showed them where it's going to be. Some people actually speculate it may have been the glory of God announcing the arrival of his son into this world. Okay? But it was supernatural. In this, they actually gave them gifts, and I actually, a little slide here, I don't know if you can read it, but right, we've got the gold and the myrrh. What on earth is that? It's Frankenstein, since they're frankincense. There you go. Yeah, there you go. But think about this. They present the gifts, and then soon after, an angel tells the Magi to do what? What does he tell the Magi to do? Go and don't go back to Herod. And then what does he immediately right after that tell Joseph? Get up and go to Egypt. Get out of here, because what was Herod about to do? Herod now made the announcement to kill all babies two years old and under in the Bethlehem area. How would a carpenter with a 14-year-old wife who just gave birth in a town they don't even live at afford to go and stay in Egypt? They had gold, frankincense, and myrrh, guys. There's purpose. This story didn't just happen in a vacuum. It wasn't just there. There was planning and there were things that happened that made this story happen. That's beyond the traditions that we're in. So I have three major points that I want to talk about here on this. Number one, God's plans are always greater than we could possibly imagine. You can put your mind to it. You can study it. You can go your whole life on just one. You could spend your whole life on just this one topic, understanding history, understanding the things behind it, and all the things that happen, and not come to a complete understanding of what God's plan really is. But let me go first step further for you. You can't possibly imagine the story of your own life. You can't possibly imagine all of the things that happened in history to bring you to the faith that you're at now and what future is going to hold for you and the people that you're going to be an influence of. Our history goes all the way back to the apostles. They walked and talked with Christ, and they found something that they needed to share. And four of those people shared them in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. An eyewitness testimony of who Jesus was, and that influence and impact impacted someone's life and impacted someone's life, and this chain of events happened until you. That's how special you are. That's the power of God's plans. You can't even know them. We downplay God's plans all the time. We cheapen them to we three kings of Orientar. Second, traditions are not ever what they seem. Let me tell you about a tradition. At this National Guard base, there was this old wooden bench, and it was a green bench, and there was two guards standing guard over this bench, and they each had rifles. And the new commanding officer that was taking over for the installation walked up and said, "Hey, why are you guys guarding this bench?" And they said, "Well, the previous commanding officer told us we needed to guard this bench." "Okay, no big deal." So he goes back to the previous guy and says, "Hey, why are they guarding this bench?" "Well, the previous commanding officer told me to watch this bench." Okay? Well, he gets curious and he goes all the way back, three previous commanding officers, finally gets the guy who just retired, because he was four commanding officers ago, and he goes, "Hey, there's two guards guarding that bench." And the guy goes, "Wait, the paint's still wet?" Okay? Traditions are born that way. There's not usually evil intent behind it, but the tradition of Christmas itself doesn't have pure motivations. It was the merging of a pagan idea in a holiday and a Christian holiday so that the everybody would get along. Okay? Now, look, the idea that we're going to at least try and remember who Christ was and remember that he was born and he was, all of that is good, but look what we've done with the tradition. It went so far as in 1200 AD, a guy finds three skulls, okay? Finds three skulls in 1200 AD, 1200 years after the wise men's story, and says, "I found the three skulls of the three kings in the wise man's story. And not only did I find them, but we're going to have these as relics, and we're going to put them, and we're going to build this giant cathedral around them and celebrate these skulls 1,200 years later of the three kings of the story." That's where we get the carol. That's where we get the tradition. And it had nothing at all to do with the reason for what we do. Guys, at this moment, I say remember James Bond, if you want a memory. But my James Bond, not the real James Bond. Look at the traditions that you go through. Understand there's a reason. There's a purpose. And it can be discovered if you open your eyes. Religion and tradition have done a great job of watering down everyone's views of reality. They've brought this worldly idea to us that we're on our own, we're by ourselves, there is no God, we're alone, you name it, all of these things have been in there to try and pollute the truth that God wants us to live. So I challenge you, look where true knowledge and wisdom actually come from. Okay? And I say here, Proverbs 9:10, this actually comes, I was put onto this and when I started doing some classes with Grand Canyon, a class actually presented me this as a beginning to the class. Fear of the Lord is the foundation of wisdom. When it says fear here, it doesn't mean trembling fear, it means a reverence. I like to say it this way, come before God humbly because he's God and you're not. Knowledge of the Holy One results in good judgment. I wanted to end with this, and I'm going to end with this, but I'm going to extend on it because interesting things happen as you... It's amazing. Not only do we have the Word of God, and we're going to talk about this, but we have people. And as I get around God's people, as people come up to me at church and other places, we talk, and God uses them to influence me. And so we're sitting back here, and we're praying, I'm listening, and I realize that I kind of left this incomplete. So I'm going to go with this verse, but then I'm going to complete the verse. For the word of God is alive and powerful. It is sharper than the sharpest two-edged sword, cutting between soul and spirit, between joint and marrow. You want to know what truth is? Where does the source of that truth come from? Word of God. And it will divide you. It will show you. It will lay open truth if you just seek after it. It exposes our innermost thoughts and desires. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God. Everything is naked and exposed before his eyes. And he is the one to which we are accountable. Now, that's awesome. But I do believe that a lot of churches let it lie right there. Okay? Religion likes to let it lie right there. Because if you let that lie right there, what you end up with is shame, guilt, hiding. The very thing that Adam and Eve did. They hide from God. So if you're going to seek after truth, if we're going to look beyond our traditions, if we're going to see what goes on here, what needs to be the result of that search? So, I'm going to finish it. This is Hebrews 4, 12 and 13, and I'm going to go on to 14 and 15. So then, since we have a great high priest who has entered heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. This high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced all of the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So, and here it is, let us come boldly to the throne of our gracious God. There we will receive his mercy, and we will find grace to help us when we need it most. Guys, God doesn't leave us with just know the truth and understand your where you're at and live in your guilt and your shame. He asks you, he says, see beyond it and see I'm merciful, I'm gracious, and the tradition of this season is beyond anything we could possibly imagine. God's plan was to bring us a Savior. His plan was to give us grace and let you live this life in amazing ways in the light of his love and your ability to love each other. I love you guys.